Well, comrades, perhaps it's appropriate that I mention the fact that this is the first time I've addressed any meeting with comrades for 15 years. So I don't know whether that's to your advantage or your disadvantage, but we'll see. Now, I know there probably won't be many £10 notes being a meeting of students, but if you were to look at the back of a £10 note, you would see that there's actually a picture of Charles Darwin there. And what's significant is that Darwin has a special place among scientists, and we need to examine why he has that particular special place. We're celebrating this year the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth. He was actually born on exactly the same day as Abraham Lincoln, as it happens. But we're also celebrating in November the 150th anniversary of the publication of Origin of the Species, which is the book that really made Charles Darwin famous. And if you look at other, shall we say, similar British scientists, there is no parallel, really, to Darwin. Darwin is possibly the single most important scientist that's come out of Great Britain. If not, then certainly he runs Isaac Newton a very, very close second. And yet, there is no such thing as Isaac Newtonism. We have Darwinism, we have an ism after Darwin, but we don't have an ism after Isaac Newton. About 50 years before Charles Darwin, another British scientist called Dalton developed his atomic theory, which really forms the basis of all modern chemistry. Now, Dalton's atomic theory is accepted without argument, not only by chemists, but probably by all scientists. There is no such thing as Daltonism. And if you look at any other parallel, any other scientist, whether British or international, going back for the last 200 years, there is no other scientist whose ideas are still challenged to the same extent that Darwin's ideas are challenged 150 years later. And what's more, by exactly the same arguments. The reason, of course, as I've come to explain, the reason why Darwin's ideas are special is because at that time and today, Darwin's ideas drive a coach and horses through all of the basic fundamental philosophies of the church. All of the old ideas of religion and superstition were really knocked over in one fell swoop by Charles Darwin. And those people who today still stand on the ideas, the religious ideas of the church or Islam, cannot really accept Darwin's ideas, even though they pretend to accept other scientific ideas. And that's the reason why Darwin's ideas are still challenged today. It's interesting that exactly the same arguments are used. There was a Presbyterian minister before Darwin published his book who actually wrote an essay to justify belief in God, and he described the scenario. Imagine finding a watch on a piece of heathland, and if you looked at the beauty of this watch and all its intricate mechanisms, you couldn't help but believe that there was some maker, somebody had made this watch. There must be a watchmaker somewhere. Of course, by analogies, the same applies to the world. And you can find a website today that actually has a similar questionnaire. It says, do you know of any car that didn't have a maker? Answer yes or no. Do you know of any house that was built that didn't have a builder? Answer yes or no. Do you know of any, and it goes on like this. In other words, it uses exactly the same arguments to justify the existence of God. And I had the same argument, not a century ago, but almost a half a century ago when I was at school. And I remember to this day a teacher talking to me and saying, well, you know, here we were in the library, here we're in the library, look, the books are all arranged, thousands upon thousands of books and sections, fiction, non-fiction, and non-fiction are subdivided and all the appropriate sections and so on. How could you not believe that this was created, that this arrangement was made by somebody, notably a librarian? Well, if you look around at the world, all of the wonderful intricacies of the world, the marvels of nature, all of the different species, the millions upon millions of species, would not believe it was made by someone. So exactly the same arguments are put forward today. And the point is that reading Darwin's ideas then and understanding Darwin's ideas today, and unfortunately a lot of people still do not understand Darwin's ideas, those ideas completely knock to one side all of the ideas of superstition and religion. Because for the first time, Darwin explained not only the existence of living things, but Darwin explained also the position of human beings from a purely materialist point of view. He gave no credence in his ideas at all to spirit, to metaphysical ideas, to the ideas of God or ghosts or anything, or fairies or anything of the kind. His analysis were purely based upon a study of the material existence, the material things that of which nature comprises. Now, I think it's necessary, I don't know how many of you are scientists or studying science, but I think it's necessary, at least briefly, to outline what the ideas of Darwin were. Darwin didn't develop the idea of evolution, because by his time, the idea that there was evolution was quite current among scientists. There was a growing idea that species changed from one type to another. Certainly by then, scientists had begun to catalogue the millions of species of different plants and animals on the planet. We now believe that the number of species goes into millions, tens of millions, and perhaps even then a lot of species are not known. And these, for the first time, were catalogued by a Scandinavian scientist called Linnaeus. And it also became apparent that species changed, because fossils had been discovered by then. Detailed analysis of fossil remains had been begun by then. And scientists began to realise that here were animals that no longer existed, that quite clearly were extinct, that no longer lived. The big animals, dinosaurs, not so big animals, all kinds of animals. And it was already developing as quite a detailed science. So Darwin didn't invent this, but for the first time, Darwin described a mechanism based upon material conditions that explained how one species would move and evolve into another species. Darwin looked at the basic ideas of inheritance. First of all, that the general features of one generation are inherited by the next generation. That's a general characteristic that we all recognise. That a dog gives birth to puppies and nothing else. A cat gives birth to kittens and nothing else. The general features of an animal or a plant are inherited by the succeeding generations. That much is known, and that much is fairly common sense. Darwin also added to that the idea that there is a variation within a population. So that if you look at a population of human beings, there is variation. We all have different features, facial features, different heights, different widths and so on, the length of fingers and so on. All of these things will vary, eye colour, hair colour and so on. And there's a natural distribution and variation within any population. And those features also are inheritable. So that you would come to resemble, to some extent, your father and to some extent your mother. And that, again, is a natural thing that was taken for granted. Not only was it taken for granted, but it was actually used by people who domesticated plants and animals for thousands of years. And that's how different hybrids of plants and animals were developed. Now, what Darwin pointed at in the case of domesticated animals, he referred to as artificial selection. Somebody who would breed a dog or pigeons, he used the example of pigeons, would select particular animals or particular birds, and he would decide, or the owner would decide, that they would breed. It would be the same with dogs. If you wanted a long-legged dog, you wanted to breed a dog that could run fast, so it had long legs, then unfortunately for the poor short-legged dog in the litter, you didn't let it breed. And the longest dogs in the litter, you let them breed. And then in each succeeding generation, out of the variation that you got, you chose the feature that you want and you bred that animal. And over many hundreds of generations, animals and plants would have developed to have certain features. And that's how domesticated animals arose, not by accident, but by breeding. And that's how domesticated plants, if that's the right word, for cultivated plants, that's how they were bred over many generations. And Darwin described this as artificial selection. But then Darwin added to that the idea of natural selection. Suppose that nature and the conditions of nature actually favoured one within a population, with the variation you got within the population, suppose the conditions favoured one particular feature more than another feature. And so statistically, the next generation would be slightly changed. The next generation would change because that particular feature was favoured, so that animal was more successful in staying alive long enough to regenerate more often, or even just in staying alive long enough to regenerate at all. So therefore, the statistical balance within the variation would change. Again, if you use an example of an animal, which the example of one feature, say, how the length of the leg of an animal. And if you can imagine that the length of the leg of an animal would determine how fast it would run. And how fast it would run would determine its likelihood of survival. Then within a normal variation of populations, whether it's deer or some other kind of animal, the ones with the longest legs, the ones that could run slightly faster, had statistically a better chance of living longer, of having more offspring, of living long enough to have more offspring. So the next generations would have a larger proportion of long-legged animals than in the previous generation. So the actual balance within that variation would shift towards longer legs. Now you can imagine that happening over 1,000 generations, and you can envisage the possibility of massive changes. You can do the maths yourself. You can imagine an animal, say, no bigger than a mouse. Now imagine adding something onto the mass, onto the size of that animal, such that it was almost insignificant. Not quite, but almost insignificant. Let's just say an increase of mass of, say, 3 or 5%. So it wouldn't really be noticed in a population of mice. But if you kept adding 5% on every generation, within 1,000 generations, you'd have an elephant. It would be a massive change over a period of time. And so natural selection, taking the place of artificial selection, can impose a pressure to change on any species of organism, not just plants, of course, but animals. And that environmental pressure wouldn't just affect one feature, it would affect lots of features. It may affect colour, it may affect the general shape and morphology, leg length and so on. It may affect the digestive system because of the food. It may affect all kinds of things. It may affect lots of different features. And in that way, you can get populations actually splitting on a small scale, but populations splitting quite considerably. Imagine a large population of millions, whether it's plants or animals, it doesn't matter. And imagine that population is physically separated by some means. It might be by a river, it might be by a mountain range, it might be by a change in climate, or it might be by some other change. And the environmental pressures on one part of the population might be completely different to the environmental pressures on another population, and in effect the population split. And once the populations become split far enough, then the possibility of interbreeding between one and another becomes quite remote. And that is how, in effect, you get population shift. It wasn't that long in the remote past, for instance, that dogs and wolves and coyotes and foxes were all probably the same species. But for a variety of reasons, the population split and the different populations evolved in different directions. And that was how speciation occurred, how particular species actually developed. And we can see today how some animals have evolved away from each other, and although they're separate species, they're near enough they can interbreed, although not successfully. So horses and donkeys can interbreed, but not successfully. You can have a horse, and horses and donkeys can mate and produce mules, but mules are sterile and they can't produce baby mules. So horses and donkeys are far enough apart to be a different species, but near enough apart almost. You can imagine it wasn't very far in the past when they were part of the same population. They're near enough almost to be able to breed, but not quite. The same is true of the animals within the big cat family. Tigers and lions can breed together for one generation only, because the offspring, ligers, or tigons, depend upon which is the mummy and which is the daddy, are sterile animals and they can't breed any further. So you can see how speciation occurs as a result of environmental pressure. Now, using these ideas, Darwin was able to explain how all of the different species, he did a lot of work in the Galapagos Islands, as I think a lot of people are aware of, within the Galapagos group of islands in that general archipelago, there are lots of different species that are quite different from one island to the other. The finches particularly paid a lot of attention to how the finches were different from one island to another because the conditions were different from one island to another. And the other thing were the giant turtles. The giant turtles are different from one island to the other because the conditions were different. The conditions of the vegetation were different. And of course, Darwin put forward the idea, quite logically, that the finches had once been a single population and now they were separate species. And the giant turtles had once been a separate population, and also they had formed different species. So Darwin was able to explain, without any recourse to a designer, without any recourse to the great the great biologist in the sky, Darwin was able to explain the movement and the change from one species to another. And so the idea developed that a lot of different species would have evolved, and so you got the idea of the kind of root species branching out. It's a bit more complicated than that, but you got this idea of species branching out, different species, and if you work backwards, of course, you get the idea that all of the mammals would have come from one original species, all of the vertebrates from one species, and so on. And the important thing about Darwin's idea is that there was no aim. There was no purpose. It stood in direct contradiction to the ideas that were being put forward at the time by a lot of so-called evolutionists who based their ideas around the church. Some of the evolutionists of Darwin's day said, yes, of course, we know there are lots of different species, and we know that lots of species change. This is all part of God's grand design. This is all part of the wonder of the Almighty. But Darwin explained quite clearly, it was a big shock to a lot of people within English society 150 years ago, that this change took place without any purpose. No, there was no particular purpose. There was no particular design or aim behind it. And even today you get people who kind of have got this vague notion about evolution, which somehow has mankind at the top as the kind of acme of perfection. And even you even get scientists talking about higher species and lower species, as if there was some God-ordained pathway from the lower species, that is to say, bacteria and single-celled organisms, to mankind, which is the acme of perfection. And even today you get this idea put forward. But the basic idea of Darwinism says there is no aim or purpose. This kind of development, this kind of change, if you like, is purely accidental, in the sense that it's not directed or driven by any superpower. And of course you can see why at the time the church was absolutely appalled by Darwin's idea. His own relationship with the church, perhaps if I've got time we can talk about it later, his own relationship with the church was quite ambivalent. He was a country gentleman. His whole way of life revolved around the Church of England. You had to be associated with the Church of England to get into Oxford or Cambridge in those days. It was part and parcel of middle class life in middle class England. So his personal association with the church was always ambivalent. I think he saw the church more as a social organisation, and in his local parish church he participated in the church right through to the end of his life. But he participated in the sense of it being a social organisation that sponsored charities, that organised good works, things like that. But as a believer, it's quite clear from Darwin's later papers that his own ideas were quite different, and he'd moved completely away from the idea of God as a creator. He says quite clearly, some of the quotes I can give if there's time, that he doesn't believe in the Bible as a, and he doesn't believe in God in the same sense that a lot of the rest of the Church of England did. But of course his ideas were really like a thunderclap as far as the church were concerned, and hundreds of books were produced. Hundreds of people tried to refute the ideas of Darwin, because they couldn't accept this basic idea that there was no room, in evolution for God. They couldn't accept the idea that mankind was knocked off his pedestal. Mankind wasn't any longer on a pedestal, you know, made in the image of God, but man was just another animal that had evolved from a lower order of animals, in inverted commas, from a different order of animals. And they couldn't accept it. And even today, 150 years after the origin of the species, that's the reason why, that's the fundamental reason why Darwin's ideas are still not accepted. A lot of people still find it hard to, I don't know, for some reason, understand Darwin's ideas. I found it remarkable that even an eminent astronomer like Fred Hoyle, I don't know if you've heard of Fred Hoyle, but Fred Hoyle and his collaborators were the originators of what's called the steady state theory in cosmology. Quite an eminent scientist, he died about 10 years ago, quite an eminent scientist and an author of science fiction as well. And Fred Hoyle made a famous comment once where he couldn't accept Darwinism. He said it was like, imagine a hurricane blowing through a scrapyard and creating a jumbo jet at the other end. And, you know, the chances of that happening are just infinitesimally remote. But that shows a fundamental misunderstanding of evolution by natural selection. The whole point about evolution by natural selection is that the tiniest change can be accumulated if it's a useful change, if it adds something useful to that population. And the slow accumulation of many, many, many useful changes can produce an enormously complicated mechanism from something that didn't have any sense of purpose or direction behind it. Now, as I said, the opponents of Darwin were bitterly opposed to the ideas that he put forward, and the church really still is opposed to those ideas. As the church, in fact, has opposed all of the most modern and revolutionary ideas of science. After all, let's not forget that the church placed Galileo under house arrest and threatened the excommunication of Galileo because he said that the earth goes round the sun. And the collaborator of Galileo, 10 years before, was actually burned at the stake for saying the very same thing. And the church has always opposed any great revolutions in science. And if truth be told, the church, even today, does not accept the fundamental idea of evolution through natural selection. They still cling on to the idea of there being a designer, a creator. It's remarkable how much the ideas of the church still actually hold sway among a lot of people today. There are various opinion polls. I quoted some of the opinion polls in my article, showing that large numbers of people still believe that humanity was created 10,000 years ago by a creator, that we didn't evolve from apes or other animals. I remember seeing a television program a couple of years ago, and I was astounded to hear some medical students. These were actually Muslims, the students who have been interviewed on the television, and they said, well, we know what we've got to write for our exams, to pass the exams, but we don't believe that. We believe the world was created by Allah 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, whatever it was. And it's surprising how much those kind of ideas still manage to cling on. And yet, since the days of Darwin, his ideas have been completely vindicated, all of his ideas. He says quite clearly in his works that he doesn't understand the mechanism for inheritance. Inheritance was known. It was known that features inherited. But since then, science has described in great detail and understands perfectly well the mechanisms of inheritance. We have the idea of genes developed partly through the work of Gregor Mendel, the Russian scientist. The idea of genes as a unit of inheritance, that particular features inherited. And modern biochemistry has shown that inheritance works through DNA or RNA, giant molecules inside the cells of living things. I won't bind you with science if you're not already science students, but it's quite well understood now that DNA molecules that make up chromosomes are the actual physical mechanisms that actually conduct inheritance from one generation to the next. And it's been demonstrated by not just hundreds or thousands, but tens of thousands of scientists working in biochemistry all over the world over the last 50 years. Not only that, but it's been clearly demonstrated that every single living thing on the planet, without exception, every single living thing on the planet has an inheritance mechanism based upon this, exactly the same biochemistry. And scientists have even taken, have spliced bits of DNA. They've taken bits of DNA from one chromosome and put it into another chromosome and demonstrated that that affects the inheritance. So the ideas of Darwinism have been deepened, have been strengthened, have been reinforced by modern scientists 1,000,000,000 times over. So in no way undermining Darwin, but reinforcing him a million times over. And of course, as far as Marx and Engels were concerned, Marx and Engels read the ideas of Darwin. They weren't particularly happy with his style of exposition, but that's a minor thing. The most important thing is that they saw the ideas of Darwin as a vindication of their political methods. Let's not forget the political methods of Marx and Engels were based upon materialism. They, in contradiction to a lot of the even the socialists of the day, still who kind of clung on to this idea of somehow human beings being special, some kind of ideal that human society had to move towards. Marx and Engels rooted their ideas in materialism, in the material conditions, the material situations that people faced. And Marx actually said this provides a natural basis for the ideas we've developed about class struggle. Marx and Engels looked upon class struggle and the material conditions of workers as being the foundation upon which political movements and cultural movements developed. And they saw Darwin really as a vindication of their ideas. Darwin's ideas have also been developed, if you like, in another way that shifts it a little bit towards Marxism. In the days of Darwin, all the emphasis was placed upon gradualism. Well, again, that's naturally the case, because what Darwin wanted to emphasise, which scientists of his day and his collaborators wanted to emphasise, wasn't that the Earth was 4,000 years old or 5,000 years old, but they wanted to emphasise, on the contrary, the fact that the Earth was millions of years old. Now, of course, we know it's billions of years old. But they wanted to emphasise how old the Earth was, not how young the Earth was. So all of their emphasis was on gradual change, upon millions of generations gradually accumulating change. Of course, nowadays that's been given a slightly different edge, when it's now quite clear that evolution doesn't happen always gradually. Sometimes evolution happens sometimes in an explosive way, and you had 600 million years ago a huge speciation known as the Cambrian explosion, and in geological time, geological time is a lot different to human time, of course, let's remember, in geological time that was a massive and sudden and explosive branching out of many and many many different species. So it's quite clear that in the history of the Earth, sometimes punctuated by things like asteroid impacts and all kinds of volcanic activities and things like this, but in the history of the Earth there have been periods where there's been relatively little, shall we say, evolution, relatively little speciation, relatively little development. And that's been interspersed with periods of massive change and massive development. So in a way, it also comes close to the ideas of Marx and Engels, because they also saw human development in the same way, that human development didn't always take place gradually and slowly, that it would take place sometimes during periods of relatively slow development, interspersed with massive revolutionary movements and big social movements. It fitted in with their ideas. A lot of the ideas of Darwin, I think, have been misused and abused. I won't perhaps go into them in detail because I haven't got time. But certainly Darwin's ideas have been misused to justify, in inverted commas, to justify class society. Marx didn't use the expression "the survival of the fittest." He liked the idea of evolution through natural selection. That was his particular phrase. But the idea of the survival of the fittest was an expression used by one of his collaborators. And he kind of shrugged his shoulders metaphorically and went along with it. But that idea of the survival of the fittest has actually been used by the right wing often to justify class society, with the allegation that those people who are at the top, the billionaires at the top, are only there because they are fitter. They are more fit, and they are more fitting for that role than the people at the bottom of society, the ignorant masses below that. So the ideas of Darwin have often been distorted. But of course, Darwin himself understood that there is something you have to take into account in human development, which didn't apply in the development of other plants and animals. Not God, not the spirits, not the Almighty, but the fact that once having achieved a society, then the development of society would have its own laws and its own types of development. And even that, by the way, has been taken up by some Darwinists, I think in an interesting way. I'm a little bit agnostic as to how accurate and how worthwhile the ideas are, but even they've been taken up by some ideas. Richard Dawkins, for instance, the author of The God Delusion, has developed this idea not of genes, which are inherited, but of memes, what he calls memes, ideas which are inherited. So he's trying to bring the ideas of natural selection into a social environment. It's not a bad idea, it's a useful discussion, and I think it's an interesting idea. The idea that he sees a meme as a cultural idea, cultural concepts, which if they're useful, if they're favourable at a particular time, will be reproduced by other people. If they're not favourable, then those ideas will die out. It's not, it's an interesting idea. I wouldn't altogether throw it out. I think it's something worth looking at. But it's at least an acceptance of the idea that society has laws of development and laws of motion that are a little bit different, shall we say, special, compared to the laws of motion that apply to human beings before the development of humanity. This is a meeting of the Marxist Society, I believe, at the University of London, and I think it's fitting that we should actually acknowledge the enormous contribution that Darwin made, as I say, perhaps the, or certainly one of the most important scientists in the history of science. Even that's not an exaggeration. And my feeling is that the ideas of genuine Marxism are a tiny minority in society at the present time, a small minority, and it's all the more important therefore that those who do ascribe to the ideas of Marxism, it's all the more important that we hang on to the basic ideas of Marxism, the basic roots of Marxism. And the most important root of Marxism, in my opinion, is the idea of materialism, that natural development and social development doesn't owe anything at all to fairies or ghosts or ghouls or gods or spirits or anything of the kind, but only to material things. And I think it's perfectly fitting, therefore, that we acknowledge and we celebrate the 150th anniversary of Darwin's birth and the 200th anniversary of Darwin's publication of Origin of the Species.